Last time you were here, it was on the occasion of this beautiful room was empty.
That's right. And it was during a hurricane, I think, or something. Or at least, I remember coming up here and the whole city was just deserted.
Maybe it was a holiday.
No, there was a hurricane coming in and there were great X's of on all the windows because they were afraid the windows were going to be blown out.
My notes, when I finish an interview, I go through it and make notes and mark the cuts I want to take out, and I see I have this dated April 28th, 1988.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's 3 years ago.
Right.
Almost 3.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't you fill me in a little bit? That book was a beautiful, beautiful book. And tell me what you have been doing since the publication of This Beautiful Room Was Empty.
I have been working steadily on the biography of Jean Genet, who was a French novelist and playwright, whose most famous plays, I guess, were The Balcony and The Blacks. And he died in 86, and soon after I started working on his biography, and I was living in Paris in those years. Now I'm back in America teaching at Brown, but for this semester only, I'm in Paris to finish the biography. And it's a lot of fun. It's really been very interesting.
You were also a longtime correspondent for, I believe, Vanity Fair.
Right. I work for Vogue, for Vanity Fair. Now I'm writing for House and Gardens, but it's always Condé Nast. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And this was a column from Paris you were doing.
Well, for Vogue, I did write a letter from Paris, but now for Vanity Fair, I did just feature stories. Now for House and Gardens, I'm writing profiles of people and discussing their houses.
Gee, the House and Gardens. I live in a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. That's not the kind of magazine I would subscribe to.
HG? Yeah, but it seems to be very popular, and it has a lot of good writing in it and a lot of interesting ideas about decorating, even for small apartments.
I know. Some of these magazines seem to be talking to people I don't know. Vanity Fair is one of them. Harper's Bazaar. Not Harper's Bazaar. Fame, it's out of business now, but magazines of that ilk, even New York Magazine to a certain degree, there seems to be a group of people that they're addressing, and I'm always looking in at them. I'm outside, you know. I'm not one of them. You know what I mean? You ever get that feeling?
Oh, sure. I mean, I feel that especially with Vanity Fair, but I think that's part of the excitement of reading it, is that you feel like a voyeur, that you're in on this glamorous life, you're getting to look at it.
Spy Magazine is another one there. Satirical magazine talking about people I've heard of but don't really know. I feel like you have to be part of the power elite, the literary elite of some kind to be reflected in that magazine. almost all of those magazines. Well, you're here on the occasion of an anthology called The Faber Book of Gay Short Fiction. I know and, in fact, have interviewed quite a number of the people who have stories represented in this book. Tell me a little bit about the origin of the book and why it was felt that it was necessary to have an anthology of gay short fiction.
Well, Faber and Faber has been doing a series of anthologies, the Faber Anthology of Canadian Fiction, of Australian Fiction, and so on. And it was their idea to do it. And I think the first thing that recommends it is that it's an awfully good read. I mean, in other words, many of the very best writers of the last 100 years have been gay. And for me, it was very much just exactly according to my own tastes. In other words, I didn't worry about tokenism, having one person from this region and one person from that race. I simply put in the things that I had enjoyed reading myself and that I thought would give pleasure to people. It's a book that could very well be used in a lot of the burgeoning classes around America in lesbian and gay fiction. I taught one of those courses myself at Brown last spring, and it's hard to put one's hands on good material that's easily available. So this sort of brings together all the gay male fiction. I think that Faber now is planning to do an anthology of lesbian fiction, because this book was quite a success in England, and I hope it will be in America.
Well, the writers represented, are they pronounced gay writers, or are they writers who have written about gay themes?
I think all the writers are themselves gay, and for instance, I remember once having something of my own in an anthology, in which the idea was to have the one gay story, oftentimes by otherwise straight writers. In other words, Hemingway's one gay story, Faulkner's one gay story. And that seemed to me an amusing idea, but sort of off the point. It seemed to me that what the new field of gay studies, which is one of the hottest fields in university life these days, is what that's interested in is people who actually have lived a gay experience and have reflected it in their work.
Now, a number of the writers are English, which, of course, is not surprising. Faber and Faber is one of the major publishing houses in England, so I'm not too familiar with some of them. I, of course, am familiar with most of the American writers. But this book, published by Faber and Faber, is it readily available in the States?
It's just now coming out. It I hope it will be well distributed. Faber has an office in Boston now, and they're beginning to distribute their books and even print them over here. So they're trying, just as the BBC is trying to establish a foothold in America now, in the same way Faber's is trying to do that too.
Now, you have a rather poignant foreword to this book in which you describe a number of years ago forming a writers' group of gay writers. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, it was in the late 70s, and it was a group called the Violet Quill, and it was extremely informal and kind of silly, as the name suggests. Basically, we would just meet in each other's living rooms. Most of us were just beginning to get published, and none of us was well known. And there were eight or nine of us, and we would all get together, and we would each week somebody different would read. And it was a good way of getting responses from friends who were also professional writers. And it was a way of giving yourself a deadline. And it was sort of like a writer's workshop, but a very informal one.
Who were some of the members of the group?
I think Andrew Holleran, who wrote Dancer from the Dance, which was an excellent book in the 70s, was one of the best ones. There was Michael Grumley, whose posthumous novel, Life Drawing, is just now coming out with an introduction that I wrote for it, published by Grove Press. There was Robert Farrow, who wrote Second Son. There was George Whitmore, who wrote Nebraska. There was Chris Cox, who wrote a wonderful guidebook to Key West. And of all those people I've named, I think only three of us are still alive.
Yes, you said the literary landscape over a period of about 8 or 10 years changed when you came back to the States from Paris. This group is pretty well decimated by the scourge of AIDS, or as James Purdy would put it, the pest.
Or the plague, or the pest.
The pest is, I think, pest. The way he...
like Camus' pest. Book, The Plague, I think in French is called La Peste, so why not?
The way he phrased it. So it really, the disease really decimated not only a good segment of the gay community, but the gay literary community.
Yes. I mean, I think actually the arts in general in America have been very influenced. I remember when I was in Key West not long ago talking to someone who said that even something like interior decorating, you know, has completely changed in America, that all the really hot shots, a lot of them have died. And so, and that's true in fashion, it's true in theater, it's true in writing, in all the various arts, and in academic life too.
I was talking to Paul Manette recently. Now, he is also a man who is, I guess he's about your age, close to 50, mm-hmm. in that area. And he said virtually everybody he knows of his age has the AIDS virus or has died.
Right. Yes, he's a friend of mine, and I think when we see each other, we sort of hug onto each other like we're the last survivors of a generation. It sometimes feels that way. And he's HIV positive, as I am. So I think for both of us, we feel that there's a definite timeline. In his case, I know it's made him plunge into his work and become extremely productive. In my case, it's made me want to take more pleasure in everyday life and not be particularly productive. Although, as you'll see when the Genet book comes out, it is an enormous effort that probably would have taken anybody 5 years to do. But at least for me, I don't think my emphasis has really been so much on work as on travel, on being with friends, on seeing operas and plays and things that I wanted to see.
Well, the last time we spoke, I don't believe you knew you were HIV positive. How did this come out? How did you learn this?
I did know. I probably didn't mention it at the time, although I, in fact, came out honestly and openly about it very early on. That is, as soon as the test was available, which was 1985, I had the test, and I found out I was positive. And I think I was one of the first people to really talk about it openly in interviews, and because it seemed to me that since there are several million people in the world who are HIV positive now, and since there appeared to be almost no one willing to talk about it in a personal way, that it seemed to me it was important to discuss.
Well, how has it affected your life in a physical sense? Because you don't seem to show any symptoms at all.
No, it's been very strange in the sense that I suppose when I first found out, I thought, well, within a year or two, I'll be dead. That was 85. Now here it is. All these years later, and I'm in perfect health. I've never suffered a single symptom, and my blood counts are all perfectly normal, except that I'm still testing positive. So I think all you can say is that for the moment the virus is dormant, and who knows what makes it awaken and become active. But I think when I first found out, I was fairly depressed for about a year. And now I'm just going on living life as usual, because after all, when you get to be our age, I mean, there are a lot of people who are dying anyway from other things. It's not as though this is some peculiar fate. I mean, Angela Carter, for instance, who's a wonderful British novelist, is a good friend of mine who's my age. She has lung cancer, and she doesn't have long to live, you know. So I think this is a thing that happens to people. I mean, death isn't something that's unique to gay people.
Yeah, I have a feeling that while knowledge of having the virus is at least at first devastating, as we get older, and I'm 55, we begin to think in terms of our mortality more than ever before. When you're young, yeah, you know, you just can't imagine being hurt. I mean, I used to drive recklessly and drink all night, and it's crazy, and I just... Well, I guess I still drive recklessly when I think about it, but not in the same way that I did before. I mean, I was driving cars and country roads in such a way that I'm just amazed I didn't have a one-car pileup someplace. But that's because you think you're going to live forever. But,
sure, you feel invulnerable.
Yeah, but when you get older, you see the people around you become frail, become ill. Your parents die, your friends die. I've been here at CBS for 25 years. I've worked with a lot of people, and you can't work in a single place without knowing people who die.
Sure.
You know, it's people that you have worked with for many, many years.
So sure.
It's wrenching. But when you said you have been speaking publicly about it, but this is part of an ongoing, I hate to use the term campaign, but maybe message would be a better phrase, among many people, including Paul Monette, to acquaint people with what this is about, what this devastating disease means.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that the most important message, of course, that you can possibly get across is the whole idea of safe sex. I mean, that it's important for straight people and gay people to practice safe sex, which basically means using condoms. I think that is the thing that will keep the disease from being spread to another generation.
Let's go back to the short fiction. In the Faber book of gay short fiction, which, of course, you've edited, these are very personal selections, I would assume, because you are the editor, and I guess you had the sole discretion to select what pleased you. But what are there any common themes that run through each of these individual stories?
Well, not all of them, but one of the things I noticed after having made a selection purely on the basis of taste, I then read through them all again to see if there were themes, and one of them I noticed was the theme of travel, that it seems to me that oftentimes gay people in the past particularly, but even now, have felt that if they went elsewhere, that things would be better, that they would be better, they would be more open, freer, more honest, or they would discover another country in which was more tolerant, more compassionate, more open, sexier. And I think that in the case of the English, they oftentimes went to North Africa or to Greece. I think in the case of Americans, they oftentimes went to Europe. I think that this theme of travel seems to be a very important one, and because I think it's easy to fantasize that the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. The other theme that I think I've noticed a great deal is an insight into society and its dynamics in general. It seems to me that gays, because they have a strange double status, that is, if you take a white middle-class homosexual like me, if I hadn't been gay, I probably would have been the most sort of ordinary conventional wasp. And I think the fact of being gay was the one thing that sort of set me apart. And since most people didn't know I was gay when I was growing up, I think that I was somebody who was able to go to prep schools, work for Time magazine, have a fairly conventional middle-class life, and yet always be aware that people were, even friends of mine, were telling jokes about me. And I looked at them as though they were Martians, too. I mean, in other words, their romances, their marriages, their problems all seemed rather unreal to me, or at least strange. I was always at a certain remove from the people around me, though they were the very people I'd grown up with. So it's a bit like being a stranger in your own house. And I think that is a useful ingredient for a writer. It seems to me no coincidence that so many of the greatest writers of the last century have been gay, because it seems to me that they've oftentimes been well-placed to observe society at its very heart, its very center of power, and yet they've always been at one remove. Take somebody like Gore Vidal. Because of his family position and his education, his name, he was very closely attached to the very center of American political power. But on the other hand, he always felt alien to this society.
It must be a terrible burden that you grew up with. I think you have written about it to a great degree, but to carry the secret, I think at one point, isn't it true that people who were gay were considered insane? They needed to go to a psychiatrist and this sort of thing.
Oh, sure. I mean, I was sent to one, and one of them recommended that I be institutionalized and that they throw away the key, that I was damaged goods, irredeemable. And I think that a lot of time was wasted by a lot of people, including me, going to shrinks, trying to go straight. That was something I tried to do for years. And I think it's just very confusing to everybody around you, including the women you're getting involved with and becoming engaged with, and who really don't understand why you're reacting the way you do.
Well, it's interesting. You said that growing up gay made one kind of an outsider, which in a way puts one in a good position for being a writer, because he's an observer. But I think the gay community as a whole is extremely creative in almost every field, whether it's music, art, literature, and then we go on to the subsidiary fields like well, you mentioned interior decorating and this sort of thing.
Partly it may be financial, in the sense that it seems to me the first 10 years, let's say, that anybody works in one of the artistic fields, he doesn't make any money at all. And if he has a wife and children, it's very hard to continue. It seems to me that a lot of the great artists, whether they're straight or gay, are people who don't marry. I mean, they're people who really can't afford to marry. And once you do marry, you're trapped into a whole different a style of life that precludes a creative work, unless you happen to be born rich. But there are a lot of rewards, of course.
Oh, absolutely. Now, in the stories that you have selected, a non-gay person picking up this book, how do you think this type of person would react to the stories? Can he identify with these stories?
Well, I don't know. There was a very funny review that came out in England. A woman said, "I've always been curious my whole life about gay men and what they do amongst each other, what their lives are like. Now I read this book and I'm no longer interested." In other words, she was really quite turned off and found that she'd found the answer to her question, but it didn't interest her. I thought that was a funny and fair enough reaction. It seems to me, though, that most people who have reviewed this book so far, mainly in England, have felt that it was an awfully good read. I mean, that it was entertaining writing, that there was a lot of humor in it, that there was a lot of good character descriptions, a lot of beauty in the writing. And that was certainly something I was going for.
Do you travel to London very much?
Since I was living in Paris from 1983 to 1990, it was very easy for me to hop over to London, and I did go a great deal. I had a play down there last year, and it's going to be done again in London this year. And I have a lot of friends there, and I've been published in England more successfully than in America. So I've had reason to go there.
Well, I get the feeling that there's a more repressive attitude toward gays in England than there is, say, here.
It's a very mixed sort of bag. I think legally it's more repressive there, but I think culturally it's more open there. In other words, the BBC did an hour-long primetime interview of me that's been rebroadcast 3 times on television. I can't imagine anything like that ever happening to me in America. I was made a member of the Booker Prize Committee, which is like their Pulitzer Prize, one of their 5 judges. I can't imagine ever being asked to be on the Pulitzer Prize Committee here. I'm a regular book reviewer for the London Times and for The Independent. They're 2 biggest newspapers, and most of the books I review are not gay books. They're just the newest, most interesting novels. I can't, again, ever imagine being asked to do that kind of assignment by the New York Times. So I would say that culturally, they're probably more open. That is, a small group of people in London who are interested in the arts are extremely unprejudiced against gays and are very relaxed with the whole thing. And I think gays are better integrated there than they are here.
No more prosecutions of gays.
But I think that a typical paradox is that once I was asked by the ICA, which is the Institute of Contemporary Arts, which is run by the British government, to give a talk, to come over from Paris. They paid all my expenses to give a talk about the current state of gay fiction. I then left the building, went for a walk in the park, holding hands with my boyfriend, and we were arrested. And I said, this is a crazy thing where your government invites me to come over and talk about homosexuality. Then when I walk with my boyfriend hand in hand, I'm arrested for that. And the cop said, well, you're in front of Buckingham Palace. And if you're capable of doing that, you're capable of blowing up the palace. That was his reasoning. I mean, in other words, anybody who could be so bizarre and eccentric as to walk hand in hand with another man was obviously of a criminal disposition. But so I think it's a country that's full of contradictions, but so is our own.
But what happened after this arrest?
Finally, we were released. In fact, I said to my boyfriend, we will be released the minute you stop holding my hand. If you want to make a big case of this, I'm happy to go through with it. But if you want to avoid it all, I think all you need to do is release my hand.
Well, the cop just stopped you. He didn't actually drag you down to the station.
No, but he ran our names through the computer. He went through our passports and so on.
So they are still making legal prosecutions in India?
Oh, sure.
So that's not done here?
It depends on the state. It depends on the city.
But really, it's not done. I mean, even in the redneck states, it's the laws may still be on the books, but I can't remember a prosecution for homosexual activity unless it's a blatant public display, which could also, well, it also affects heterosexuals. There was a case, I think, in Georgia where 2 heterosexuals were having sex in their own apartment and were videotaped from outside. Remember that case?
Yes.
They were videotaped through a window.
Right.
From outside.
Right. And they were doing something that wasn't the normal missionary position. So they were prosecuted.
So
I know.
But did Faber and Faber take a chance publishing this book in England? Because there would be obviously no problem here.
No, they didn't, legally or in any other way. The climate has relaxed a lot in England in terms of gay publishing because of England's inclusion in the European Economic Community. In other words, what happened in England was that the English, anything that was published domestically in England was very seldom censored. But any gay books that were imported into England could be prosecuted by the Her Majesty's Customs, and they were very puritanical, and they even seized books of mine and burned them that were being imported. They would also stage raids on gay bookshops in London and take all the books that had been imported from the States, let's say, or from Europe, and burn them. So this went on that way until finally one man challenged it. It was taken to the High European Court in Strasbourg, and there they made a decision that no member of the European Economic Community could have separate laws that would exclude the free flow of products made elsewhere in the European Economic Community. So essentially, this finding has robbed English customs of their ability to be discriminatory.
What is the climate in France?
In France, it's very, very open. I think to me, it seems the very best that of any country that I know of. For instance, if you take the whole matter of AIDS, there has never been the kind of alarmist press reaction that there was in America or in England or in Germany. The kind of screaming headlines saying, cook in grade school has AIDS, the kind of thing we had here with the New York Post. That sort of nonsense has never really happened in France. The journalist early on made a decision to treat the disease in a highly scientific way, and I think it's had excellent results. In terms of gay people in general, I think that they're very well integrated into French life, and there are several famous gay writers in France who've won all the top prizes, have been received by the president, been decorated by him. Again, I can't imagine ever being received in the White House, me, but you know, people like Yves Navarre, Hervé Guibert, several of the important French gay writers have been received by Mitterrand.
Have you ever been on Apostrophes?
Yes, I have. It no longer exists. It's out of business. But I was on this famous French book chat show called Apostrophe. And I,
Apostrophe?
Apostrophe, yeah. They don't say apostrophe, but it's spelled like apostrophe. I was called applesauce. But anyway, apostrophe.
Apostrophe. But in as we anglicize it, wouldn't we say apostrophe?
Sure, we would. But the French call it apostrophe. Yeah. And I was on that and with, in fact, Boli Soyinka, the Nobel Prize winner from Africa.
Your French must be pretty good, because yeah. The show is done in French.
In French, yeah.
Because I read a couple of stories bemoaning the fact that that show went off the air. It was supposed to be extremely popular.
It was very, very popular. And there are now a couple of other book chat shows that have replaced it, but neither is as successful. But it is interesting that in France, writers are more famous than movie stars. I mean, they're very famous in France, and somebody like Milan Kundera, for instance, told me that he really cannot walk down the street. And Foucault, I once went with him into a pub, and he was mobbed by people wanting his autograph, and he told me he couldn't go into an ordinary pub.
It's not going to happen here. I mean, literary celebrity is something apart from Hollywood celebrity. I was talking to E.L. Doctorow. He said, I can walk down any street in Manhattan, and nobody will recognize me, and 100 people could come up to me, and 99 of them had never read my books or even heard of me.
Sure, I think that's right. I remember Virgil Thompson, the composer, once saying to me, when I meet people who've never heard of me, I know then I'm in the real world.
Well, to wrap things up, Edmund White, tell me about the state of gay fiction today and who are some of the important writers coming up, and I think some of them are represented in your anthology.
Right. Two of my favorite younger writers are Robert Gluck and Dennis Cooper, both of whom have stories in this anthology, and both of whom started off in the West Coast, if they're not there still. Dennis Cooper's from Los Angeles, and Robert Gluck from San Francisco. And I think what they've done is they've taken gay fiction another step. They've tried to introduce avant-garde experimental techniques into writing about this subject matter. Instead of just doing the same old, very personal, very straightforward, realistic story about growing up gay or coming out or whatever, they are now trying to explore with new techniques the reality of actually living in a gay community.
The gay fiction today, is it going to continue to explore, when I say gay fiction, I mean fiction by gay writers, is it going to continue to explore gay themes, or is it going to break into the mainstream as many of your books have done?
Well, I think what's interesting is another writer who's the last one who's in my anthology, and that's Alan Gurganis. He represents a very interesting case because he published the first openly gay short story ever to be published by The New Yorker in the early 1970s. He's never made any bones about being gay, but the book for which he's best known, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, which was an enormous critical and commercial success in this country, is in no way gay. So in other words, he's someone who's really interested, he's a Southerner, he's interested in exploring the Southern tradition. He's not particularly interested in homosexuality as a literary theme. However, in his book of short stories, which he published not long ago, 3 of the 10 stories were gay. So, I mean, in other words, he's somebody who's perfectly open about it, but who's writing about anything he wants to write about. And I think that's the kind of full freedom that everyone really wants to have, and that probably lies down the road for most writers.
Well, Ed, it was nice chatting with you again. When can we expect to hear from Jean Genet?
Well, I turn in the manuscript in January, so I hope that the book will be out in the following fall.
Who is the publisher?
The Knopf is the publisher in America, and Gallimard is bringing it out in France, and Chatwin Windows in London. A lot of people are breathing down my neck to hurry up and turn in this manuscript.
Well, I'll be looking forward to that, and it's always nice talking to you. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to stop in and talk to us.
Well, thank you for having me.